Welcome to the Sports Law Biz Podcast, dedicated to helping people better understand the law and business of sports. I'm your host, Peter Ott, and we've got a lot to talk about here today, so why don't we just jump in? Hello, this is Peter Ott with the Sports Law Biz Podcast. I'm here today with a very special episode with Sonny Vaccaro, a man who needs no introduction, but I'll provide a brief one anyway. He's a man who basically invented the modern leather basketball shoe. He negotiated Jordan's first Nike deal. He's created showcase basketball tournaments for high school players. He's been called the godfather of summer basketball. He seems to know everybody in the sports business. And now he's dedicated to advocating for college athletes. ESPN recently did a 30 for 30 documentary about him called Soul Man. I'll link to that on the blog, and that's worth a watch. And that discusses his life, and now we're going to discuss that a little more in depth and as well as what he's doing currently. So how are you doing, Sonny?
I'm fine. I don't think I invented the leather shoe. I had some ideas to do it, a design from a shoemaker friend of mine a long time ago back in Trafford, Pennsylvania. But that's okay. That will go on from there.
Okay. Well, yeah, that's my mistake then. I'm sorry about that. Okay. So, Sonny, you grew up in Pittsburgh, went to Youngstown State. People can learn about your early life by watching that video. One thing I would like to talk about is the impetus behind creating the Dapper Dan Roundball Classic. Can you talk a little bit about that and why you did that?
I started that All-Star game on the craziest set of circumstances through a young life that you could go through. I was not a basketball aficionado. I wasn't a very good basketball player in high school. I played other sports. I got a scholarship to play football and offered to play professional baseball. So basketball was the last on the totem pole. I went to Youngstown State and I got injured. They offered me a 4-year scholarship. I never played a down. The basketball coach at Youngstown liked my enthusiasm or whatever it was, my Italian heritage, since he was an Italian. I have no idea to this day. And I started going around the western Pennsylvania area and picking up high school kids and playing in what was obviously a prelude to what summer basketball is today. After the high school season would be over in that part of the country, a lot of places had tournaments for all-star teams. And that's where I got hooked on basketball. I helped Youngstown recruit players while I was a student. I was only 19 years old when I actually helped Don Roselli, and I started this trick of mine through basketball, Peter. And it evolved into getting great recruits for Youngstown. In fact, two of the players I helped recruit are in the Hall of Fame at Youngstown State, which I must have known what I was doing. But more important, it brought me to forming an all-star game in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania in 1965, a basketball all-star game, which, as I said, basketball wasn't on the minds of everybody in western Pennsylvania, especially in the 60s. If you're any historian at all, it was all about football. So I thought of this idea. My cousin, my friend, my best friend in life and, until today, we communicate, a man named Pat DeCesar, who grew up to be one of the all-time great rock and roll promoters in the history of rock and roll. He brought the Beatles to Pittsburgh, helped bring the Beatles to Pittsburgh in one of their first concerts. So he and I were next-door neighbors, lifelong friends, and in Italian would-be cousins, but we physically weren't, but that we are that close. I came up with the idea of this all-star game. Pat, being a promoter, said we're going to the Civic Arena, and the next is history. We had the first game in 1965, and until I retired from all activities, it lasted 43 years. It was the first All-Star game ever in America of this nature, beating by 13 years the McDonald's game. So that's how it all started.
Okay, and when you say of this nature, what does that mean? Because you said there was these regional tournaments already, right? Yeah. And so the difference here is that it had a national scope?
Yeah, it was. I had kids from the state of California. I had kids from New York City, Washington, D.C. We actually went after Lou Alcindor, who was a senior that particular year, and his high school coach, for some unknown reason, didn't allow him to come. Everyone else did accept the first invitation. So it was national, and the Pennsylvania team played against it. That was my idea. There are these uncovered Pennsylvania basketball players that were there, and Pennsylvania played the United States, and Kareem didn't play, but everyone else said yes, and I don't think over the years we had too many rejections. Even when McDonald's and the Derby Classic and the Jordan Ferran game, all these other ones we gave birth to, Peter.
Okay. So, and that was revolutionary because it provided a forum for high school students or recent graduates to show off their skills, and coaches came as well. Did you invite the coaches, or is that something that kind of happened organically?
They just came themselves because this was a ideal place to witness the best. Now, you're talking about 1965. There was no internet. No one knew anybody in 1965.
Right.
You know, there were names in a preceding book called Street and Smith and things like that. A guy named Haskell Cohen for Parade Magazine would pick an All-American team before and just give you names out of the book. And that's when I went by and I researched them. And always it was all on payphones or letters to people. And that's how I found out. I saw all the kids in Pennsylvania and some in Ohio because I could drive there. And even in the 60s, that was a chore. Now, that's how it began. I didn't know who these kids were when they got off the planes. And so it was revolutionary in the sense that, you know, look where we are today with the McDonald's game lasts 16 weeks to play because they come in on Monday and they have dunk contests. And so everything's on national television.
Right.
We were the first and we were great.
Okay. Yeah, no, it sounds like it was a good time. Everybody who was associated with it seems to speak of it very fondly. So, okay, so that's kind of the beginning of your entree into the professional sports world or the, you know, large-scale sports world. And then moving on to the next phase of your life, you approach Nike. Where did that idea come from for you to go to a corporation like that?
Well, you jumped 12 years right to Nike, but I got there in a very strange way. I did the Dapper Dan. I started high school camps in you know, a resort called Seven Springs in Pennsylvania, where I had some camps. So I got to know the basketball world pretty good, Peter. And I was a coach, junior high coach, and a football coach in basketball at my high school. I taught special education for 5 years or 4 or 5 years back in Western Pennsylvania in Trafford, my high school. And then I became a celebrity in a sense that the game was the biggest game in America. We had over 200 college coaches in attendance every time we played. We had 17,000 people by the time the 70s came around. They enlarged the Civic Arena. The first game was 10,334 because that was the capacity of the brand new Civic Arena that only been built a couple years before that in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, to play hockey, really. So these things happened, and then I progressed into the 1970s by, you know, doing some agent work for the ABA. I represented George Gervin, Dana Lewis, Mickey Davis. Obviously, George Gervin, everyone knows that. He's one of the greatest players in the world. I signed George Gervin to his contract. I represented him with the Virginia Squires, I believe, 1972. So I became this figure, the start of the wanderlust of Sonny Vaccaro's mind to take it. While I was doing the high school camps that I was telling you about at Seven Springs, a lot of the kids in the camp wore their shoes differently and whatever, and I just became interested in what they were doing. I had no idea what the hell I was going to be, you know, doing, but I had an idea. I had a very good shoemaker friend in Trafford, like, again, an Italian kid, and his family had been shoemakers for 50 years, and just for the record, he died in the Hall of Fame. He just died about 6 months ago. And he put in the Hall of Fame of shoemaking. So at a very young age, he was pretty talented. He made for me ideas that I, you know, incorporated, you know, to bring to Nike. I didn't know Nike. I had no idea Nike existed because they were just a very young company. A friend of mine, Lucia Fell and Jerry Davis, were agents in New York City in the 70s. And I knew them because I was representing some of the, you know, the ABA guys. And I met a couple other people like that. And they represented the player that played for the Washington Wizards, and they you know, he said he's wearing Nike shoes. So Jerry Davis wrote me a letter to Phil Knight and said this guy had an idea about shoes. So that's how the journey began. They invited me through, you know, Phil Chenier was the player's name, a very good player if you go back historically, played for the Wizards, and I go to Nike with about 12 or 13 different designs of shoes in a knapsack. And I my own ticket to go to Beaverton, Oregon. And I meet Phil Knight and Rob Strausser and other people. You know, they were all foreign to me. I had no idea what the hell I was doing. And we had a nice dinner. It took me to a Chinese restaurant, and we talked. And I left my shoes there that they never did get back to me. And I went home. And in the course of that day, that's all it lasted, I said, you ought to come back and watch the Dapper Dan game. Rob Strasser came back that year, 77, I believe, and he saw 17,000 people in the stands. And then when he went back home and talked to Phil, they invited me to come. So that's how I met Phil Knight and Nike. A fluke, something I thought of about just tennis shoes. So I didn't invent the leather, but I invented some ideas, which spurred Nike on, which at that time was maybe a $20 or $25 million company. And all they were doing were running shoes, and they only made basketball shoes for the University of Oregon, which the owner, Phil Knight, was a runner. His coach was Bill Bowerman, who was the Olympic coach, and Steve Prefontaine, one of the greatest runners in the history of American track and field, was on that team, and that was who he died tragically in an automobile accident, and it really framed, I believe, Phil Knight's life. So that's how it began.
Okay, so you approached Nike with this idea of different design of shoes, and through your connections with the Dapper Dan, that provided a forum for you to stay in contact with them. And then what was the original plan for you with Nike? I know you've talked about arrangements where you'd pay coaches to wear basketball shoes. Is that how you started out with that idea?
No, I started out when Rob came to the Dapper Dan. I wanted them to do high school teams. I said, you want to start selling your shoes, give me some free shoes, give them to the high schools on the East Coast, because the East Coast is where they were playing basketball and the world understood it at that time. And I put it on the kids in the Dapper Dan, and I was doing these other tournaments. It was a very small but very, very influential community. College basketball wasn't big. That was the reign of UCLA. It was only 16 teams in an NCAA tournament. It was not like it is. In fact, the NIT was probably bigger than the NCAA tournament, even though Wooden and the Bruins won a lot of championships. College basketball, pro basketball was not big at all. And if anyone remembers, even when they played, I think it was in the 80s when Magic Johnson played against Philadelphia for the NBA championship, the game was tape delayed. So college basketball was coming on. I was at Nike, and they brought me out a second or a third time now. They were sending shoes to the high school teams and all that sort of stuff. I said to them one day, do you want to get in college basketball? They said, well, how do you do that? I said, pay the coaches. Simple as that, as innocent as that phrase was, they didn't know what the hell I was talking about. I don't know if I ever did either, because I didn't have an idea that's what I was going to say until the moment I said it. I didn't know that I'd go out there and say pay call. But I know all the college coaches. I had this ability because of the game. Every one of these guys were my friends. They were my friends on the surface in the sense that they'd come to the game. They wanted to know recruiting. That's all, recruiting's not like it is today. The mindset's got to understand that. They'd come to Pittsburgh and they'd see everybody of the most importance. I had a preliminary game that was unbelievable. We had all the kids in the Western Pennsylvania area play before the All-Americans played. That game produced some pros. That's how good the competition was. Jim Calhoun at Connecticut, goes on to fame at Connecticut when he was at Northeastern. He came down there and recruited three guys that led him to get the Connecticut job, and Jimmy speaks of that eloquently all the time in his life. He started, So I was this celebrity and the ability to be close to kids. I said to Nike, pay the coaches. Give the team free shoes, sweatsuits, T-shirts, and pay the coach. The coaches were not making money in the 70s. People had no concept of that. $25,000, $30,000, which they may have been making that in those years. Wooden has gone down history of saying that's the most he ever made around that number. But a lot of guys weren't making a lot of money. You got a car deal from the local Oldsmobile dealer or something like that. You ran summer camps. That's the way the life has changed. So that's how paying coaches started. Very innocently, my idea came out. They were afraid of it. And then they said, well, you want to try? And I said, yeah, I'll get it done immediately.
Uh-huh.
So I went out. Yeah. I signed Jerry Tarkanian and three or four or five other guys. I gave them a personal check, which I probably didn't have a lot of money in the checking account. In fact, it would have bounced if it got there quick. Nike then agreed to wire me the money. That's when you wired money into people's accounts and covered the check. So that's how it began, Peter.
Okay, so yeah, really kind of a grassroots level, you're paying out of your own checking account. And just to clarify, because I mean, you're familiar, some people hear Sonny Vaccaro money, they think something shady's happening. You would pay the coaches a certain amount of money, and they would encourage their students to wear Nike shoes in games. Is that how that works? You provide them with a certain amount of stuff, and then it gives Nike visibility when teams are wearing their clothing.
Well, I don't know if they're getting their stooge. They're going to get their athletes playing basketball. That's what they're getting the money for. So the basketball,
right,
where it's the shoes. Let's not confuse this spear. Okay.
Okay, yeah.
That was the idea.
Get the athletes.
Because Nike was going to sell shoes to everyone who wore basketball shoes and played basketball on the playgrounds. And on the, that was the business. That's still the business. They will influence the students, I imagine, and the general public to buy the shoe. Okay, now we're past that, Peter. So, yes, but that's what I did. And then I went around and I signed. We had 10, 9 or 10 the first year. In the second year, we were in the 70s. Otherwise, everyone was taking the money.
And
business still. Nothing wrong with that.
Right, yeah. And this was new, right? And were other
In fact,
brands.
Converse made a note that they'd never pay anybody. They demonized me. They probably started the first demonization of Sonny Vaccaro. So they said, they'll never do that. You know, they had everybody. You have to understand, Converse had everybody. That was like Adam and Eve in the tree, okay? They had all the apples they wanted, right? They had all the pizza they wanted. They had whatever they wanted, right, Peter? They had. And that's what Converse had. They had no idea.
Just by default.
Yeah, by default, right. Until they screwed it up, like Adam and Eve. They screwed it up, too. My point, I hope I'm just generally talking here. But I'm saying that's how much Converse owned. They owned everything, and we did it. This company that had no basketball teams beat them. In 3 years, we were in front of everybody.
Right, yeah. I remember reading a book about Michael Jordan, and when he was trying to decide between the shoe companies, you know, his natural preference wasn't Nike to start off with because he'd never played in Nike shoes. He'd been playing in Converse, right?
Right. He was playing in Converse. Everybody played Converse, and he might have taken Adidas because they were fashion, as they, you know, I don't know what the hell they do today, but they were fashion. Their sweatsuits were great. And they made leather shoes before anybody else, Peter. Adidas.
Okay.
So, and they were in Germany, as everyone knows, and all that sort of stuff. So that's how it happened. So it just happened. So these two things that happened in my life, three things, representing athletes like George Gervin in 1970, when I just left Trafford High School, starting an all-star game in 65, and then now Nike in 77. I mean, in 12 years, whoop.
Yeah, no, that's a lot more than a lot of people do in their whole life. So you were quick at getting things done.
Well, it turned out well for me. With a lot of people, you know, good help and all that sort of stuff. Yes, it did.
Okay. Well, let's move in to talk about the Jordan deal. So can you kind of walk us through that? Whose idea was it to go after Jordan, you know, the strategy?
Well, it was my idea to go after Jordan. That's
okay.
Mine and Nike, and no one can dispute it because we had a meeting, all the hires. It's 1984 now. Michael had, you know, we knew he was going to be going pro and all that sort of thing, and Nike didn't have any top. They had some really good pros, but they weren't doing anything with it. Really, nobody was. Magic Johnson, Julius Erving. If you really want to be honest with yourself, Julius Erving should have been, you know, Michael Jordan if someone had any brains before all of them, because Julius is magnificent. And then Magic should have certainly been, if not Julius. And, you know, they had other great players in the 70s, but no one marketed them. So it comes down to, who was Nike's first big sign going to be? We had a couple dollars and to go into pro and pay coaches, because now we owned a college game and we're paying a lot of money. That $5,000 or $10,000 gone into $100,000 and $200,000 now. So just so we understand, the money's going up. Nike's growing very, very well. They want to get, you know, they will get a pro. So we have this meeting. So Nike was there and all the hierarchy, and I would basically, I've earned my chops because of high school and thing. I never was involved in the pro basketball signings. And they asked me to come to the meeting. So we had this big meeting. There I was, the outsider type guy again. I'm still sunny and gregarious and very happy with what we did in college, there's no question, because in 83, Nike won the NCAA championship at North Carolina State. So we went from University of Oregon in 1977 wearing the shoe to the national championship in 83. That's again, just so we all quantify this whole march. And they asked, and there was good players in that draft. There was Charles Barkley, a lot of great players. Keem Elijah won, Johnny Stockton. I mean, I think there's four or five guys in the pros. I mean, in the Hall of Fame, you know, later on. So, and Nike wanted to sign two or three of them. Now, that could have been possible in a sense that a lot of guys weren't getting a lot of money. Okay, I don't know what, maybe $100,000. So it could have been done. So they said, well, we'll get two or three of these guys. That's how the meeting started. So I was just quiet. Now, I had never met Michael Jordan in my life. At that time, I didn't have a camp, the ABCD camp, but I had my All-Star game. Michael didn't play in my All-Star game. North Carolina was one of the few schools in America that did not switch over from Converse to Nike. Dean Smith was a loyal Converse person. That would change later on, but that was that's what it was. On that breath, we had no connection with Michael Jordan. Never met him. I didn't, nor anybody else, obviously, at Nike. So they want to sign these other guys, and they said, we'll get two or three of them. And I said, it just came out of my mouth, no, give it all to the kid. Right? Give it all to Michael Jordan. Well, why, I get all this discussion. It wasn't animus, whatever. Just, well, we can't do that. We got to be safe. We'll get two or three of them. We'll give each of them whatever the number was going to be divided by. But we had $500,000 to pay the athlete. That's just so we know how far that came. That's what the number was for us. Okay? And then they say, well, we'll give them like 150 this guy, 150 that guy, two or three, maybe give Jordan. So, no, give it all to him. Just show him how much you love him. And it went back and forth. And it really wasn't settled that day because as we went along, they kept questioning me. And someone asked me, I believe it was Rob Strasser, would you bet your job on this call? And first of all, my job was probably paying me $500 a month. I have no idea, but it wasn't a lot of money. $1,000 at most. I said, yeah, because that's basically my nature all my life anyway. I said, yes. So they sort of listened to me. They couldn't refute me. The call just worked out pretty damn well. I was given the permission. So I lined up the meeting with Michael Jordan through a friend of mine, George Raveling, who was a coach that I had known all my life. And he arranged a meeting during the Olympics of 84, because it was in Los Angeles that year. He had an assistant, an associate of his, and a good friend of mine named Rudy Washington, who actually drove Michael from the Olympic workout over in Southern California by the Coliseum there where they were staying. And to meet me at the Tony Romo's. That was the first time it ever happened. That was my first meeting at Tony Romo's, and I told him that we wanted him. He didn't know what the hell. I mean, but he was interested. And it was going along how I can recollect, the most important thing, obviously, other than the casual thing, because we never met each other. There's no reason for him. It's not 2 years later, and I had done things in pros and all that. And I said to him, I guess the magic words, this isn't all about money. This is about you're going to have a signature shoe. It is going to be your name, your brand. And that's where the world changed. That's why Michael's a billionaire today, not because of anything else. A thing came out, Peter, early September, that Michael Jordan made more off of brand Jordan this year than he made in his whole career from the salaries from the NBA teams he played for. He makes these $97 million or something. Unbelievable. Today. So that's right, that's where this was. And there I was sitting with this kid that I didn't know and he didn't know me. But we struck a relationship. We hit a chord and I kept pursuing him and we got him. And Nike almost to the end. I remember Nike asked Billy Packer at the Olympic Games. They went to lunch. I got Billy to come meet Phil Knight and Rob Strasser. And they sort of asked Billy, what do you think of Jordan? And Billy loved him and sort of backed up what I said. But the irony of that statement, Peter, is they still weren't sure of what I was sure of. So all these BS today, where we are today, the world has to understand, Peter, okay? It was me and Michael. So, and that's the greatest sign in the history of marketing and the history of mankind. It'll never be duplicated only because there was so much room to grow. It's not that LeBron's not great or this guy's not great or they don't sell product because they do sell product. It's obvious that athletes sell product. But Michael started from ground zero, and that's why brand Jordan is brand Jordan. You see no other brand anything anymore. You know that, don't you? One of these days you're going to maybe give LeBron brand something, but it'll never be brand Jordan.
Yeah, so and I think that's what's interesting there is not only did you have to convince, Jordan to go with Nike, but you had to convince Nike that it was worth it going all in, making Jordan more of a partner than just, paying him a wage or something like that.
Very well said, Peter. Very well said. That's exactly. It was a two-way street here, and I was the red light, I guess, green or red. That was me.
Okay. Yeah, and certainly one of your skills in life is your ability to build relationships with people. I've been in contact with you when I was planning a symposium at UVA Law, and I just felt like I knew you even over the phone before we met, and so I think that's an important thing for people. interested in sports business, interested in business at all. That's just so important to be able to make that connection with people. And you know, it's important for business, but it's important just for being a good person too, you know, getting to know people.
I thank you for saying that concerning me and, you know, my wife Pam and the thing we've done. But Peter, if you're sending the message and some of the people listening to us, if you cannot do that, I don't care what the product is or what's going to happen, eventually you're going to blow it. Because one time along the road, you just got to be, you know, you misrepresent yourself and say something that's not true or you can't back up. That'll be over with. That'll be over. That's like these silly people, you know, falsifying resumes and saying you were places where you weren't or what. You can't exaggerate. I'm trying to make emphasis on your point, Peter. Anyone listening who's going into that field, be honest. That's why I've never been afraid of anything. I made mistakes, but not mistakes because I lied or deceived somebody. That's, you know, I made a lot of mistakes. That's not even close. But when you lie, you're going to get caught. It's like stupid. Now you're going to get caught. Without any fear of getting caught, you can't do it.
Okay, well, let's move on to some other things in your experience with Nike. So you had the Jordan situation, then you moved on. The ABCD camp came after that. That was with Nike, right?
Yeah, 85. I had acquired ABCD. So the camp was not going to go on for the year 85. And I took it over, you know, and I convinced Nike to do it. And I became personally involved with everything. So ABCD evolves into, you know, Michael coming there. And then the greatest summer camp in the history of camps, no question about it. And also, for your information, until I left Nike, there were no other camps. We are the main camp like this. Now, there were a lot of camps that the individuals paid money to go to, and they were good camps, but no money. We invited all the kids in, brought their coaches in, and they went to classes, and we had great instructors, and they played each other. And Michael Jordan came to camp because that was the first summer of brand Jordan, Nike, the shoe. Obviously, one of the kids all wore brand Jordan. That's how it starts, yes.
Okay. And so this camp is more all-inclusive than just the previous tournaments that you'd been part of. There's actual training and things like that going on.
Absolutely. This is a week. It took a week. But it was academics for 3 hours in the morning by qualified teachers. But great coaches, the best coaches that, you know, you could bring in. And you couldn't bring college coaches. And then every college in America, just like the Dapper Dan, you couldn't get in our gyms. We had our first ones at Princeton University, and Princeton was Princeton, and they were very, very good and all these things, and that's where our camp was. So for 5 years, we were there, and only the best. And if you look at the rosters of that and the old Dapper Dan, the greatest players in America went through ABCD. And the longer it went, the more competitive, because when I left Nike, I kept the name. It was my name. So I took the name, and I went against Nike, and so we had Nike camp, then we had this camp, then somebody else camp, now you have Jordan brand, all that stuff. And then LeBron has his camp. But that's how it evolved. We were the first ones to do it, and we took that into when I left Nike and I went on my own. Yes.
Okay. And with this camp, and all the camps and tournaments that you're associated with, you know, there's people who say, oh, this is shady. You know, there's college coaches, there's connections being made. You know, Sonny is steering kids to certain programs, things like that. How do you respond to those kind of comments?
Ignorance. They were all ignorant. You know, and basically, Peter, a lot of it evolved, I think, because of my own persona. You know, I believe that. I was always a singular individual. But the irony of all the statements of the people who supposedly thought I was ill-reputed by some nature of birth or whatever is I was always backed by the biggest corporations in America. And, you know, Phil Knight is an icon in the world, and he's in the Hall of Fame or whatever it is. And, you know, and Adidas is, you know, viable, and Reebok, the three companies I work for. And if I was steering players to coaches, like, which was the dumbest thing I ever heard of in my life, we had 80 schools at Nike, and this was all about Alonzo Mourning and John Feinstein and other writers talking about me steering Alonzo there and national TV. But, you know, the funny thing about it is, it wasn't like my camp, it wasn't my shoe, it wasn't, you know, I worked for somebody. You think if I was doing things wrong that Phil or, you know, Peter or Rob or Adidas people and Paul Fireman, you know, you're talking about big time people. I mean, you know,
right.
Okay, why would they let this little Italian kid run around doing illicit things? See, the point is, this is, I think, I when I spoke to your group and the 30-some other schools, Peter, it goes back to the integrity and honesty of the individual making the statements. You can say anything you want, but in order for you to be clear of conscience and say those things, you better not lie. So here I am talking to you in 2015, okay? And the story goes on. There's been no fact of anything that was supposed to be, you know, connected to me that wasn't done the right way. So I never paid attention. I fought back as an individual. And it sort of gave me the opportunity to become who I am. I mean, I am quite different. But I am sunny, consistently. And that's what life is. And that's good.
Right. Well, let's move on and talk about one more thing with Nike. I know one thing that you talked about when you came to UVA is you talked about the shift from paying coaches to have their teams wear a particular shoe or something like that to having an all-school deal with an entire university. And the University of Miami was the first all-school deal in 1987. Can you talk about that? Was that your idea? Where did that come from?
Well, that came from a lawyer that I did not know, who then became very big in my life, a labor lawyer, a University of Miami graduate named Rob Ades. He knew the AD because Rob was a graduate of Miami, a big-time major lawyer, union lawyer in Washington. He just passed away about a year ago. But Rob was very influential in my life because two times he came in. On this deal here, I get a call from a man that I did not know. He said, "Mr. Vaccaro, my name is Rob Ades. Sam Jankovic, who was the AD at the University of Miami, gave me the authority to call you and ask you if you would be interested in signing the University of Miami to an all-school deal for all their athletes." And I did not know Rob, and we grew to be best of friends, obviously, through the years. And this was in 1987. The first contact was in 87. So I said, "Mr. Ades, what is it you're saying again?" "Well, Mr. Jankovic would like to make an all-school deal where you have all the schools." And I said, "So we'll have the whole school. We'll get all the sports teams." Now, the average person may have thought, well, first of all, we were a basketball shoe. Nike was a basketball shoe company. And, you know, we hadn't started the football and all that. We made some, I guess, but it was all basketball run. Okay, and running. Well, they had a great football team, obviously. There's no question about that, okay? Even in the 80s, they were the U, that all goes, you know, it's all about the U. And they had great baseball teams and swimming teams and all that sort of stuff, but their basketball team wasn't that great. So that was the first thing you would have thought. I'd have said no. So I asked for a piece. So I said, "Rob, so we'll get everything." I said, "Yeah." I said, "I like this. Will you get back to Mr. Jankovic and say I'd love to talk to him?" So he would arrange that for the next day. Now, this wasn't emails, faxes, ticker tapes, nothing, right? This was all phone. You had to be around your phone. And a lot of times in those days, I was working off of pay phones because there were no cell phones. So Rob arranged for me the next couple of days to talk to Sam Jankovic. And I get this arranged, and he calls me a day or two later, and it wasn't even the three-way. It was me and Sam. So I said, "You know, Mr. Jenkins." So now, I got to put this in. I called Rob Strasser. Rob Strasser was my mentor at Nike. He was the one I was close to. Phil and I, obviously Phil gave me the okay for everything, and he owned everything. So, but I called him and I said, I just think I heard something that's going to be great. So they asked me to explain. I said, "The University of Miami wants to do an all-school deal." And they didn't understand. I said, "Rob, Phil, they want everything. They want us to put shoes on everything." "Well, again, what are you going to say?" "Well, there's no swimmers. They don't wear shoes." "You know, track." I mean, so, you know, what good is that? We don't sell baseball shoes. And I said, "No." I said, "We got the whole school. We're going to give signs all over the building. When you touch that pool and you touch the thing, there's going to be a big swoosh, you know, and the guys, those relays, I don't know how you call it, Peter, but, you know, you touch the pool and you turn around and go the other way, you know, and there's a swoosh there in a swimming pool." And uh-huh. Then I said, "We have the bookstore." And he said, "Well, what do you mean?" "Well, that's part of it. We're going to sell all our stuff in the bookstore." Now, What does that mean? Now, in 1987 or 88, okay, it didn't mean a lot, but I knew it meant something, because by that time I was going to these games, and I was going in all the universities, and you'd always go to your bookstore to buy the T-shirt, you do. And when I went there, and the coaches would always make sure that I got a sweatsuit or something, the guys we represented there, and we went, Pam and I went to a lot of those. And it's amazing. So they're going to sell you your product. So every time your parents come to watch all these games, it isn't just you. It's all the public, right? Well, that was a bonanza. So I knew in my mind, and I convinced Rob and Phil, I said, sign them. So then Sam and I worked out a deal, and we signed the University of Miami to an all-school deal, which was the predecessor to the most important thing in all the things you're seeing of the law cases and the athletes and money in college sports. We got Nike totally involved. That's why there are now, you've got Under Armour, Adidas, Reebok, you got everybody, Chinese companies. But the all-school deals are bringing in millions. I think Michigan's just signed one for $97 million, over the years, and Notre Dame. Well, this was 1987. There was a guy I didn't know, Rob Ades. And so all the fools that talk about amateurism and all that crap, okay, and we'll get into that, I'm sure.
Right.
That when I made my statement, they sold their souls when they kept, souls, S-O-U-L-S and not S-O-L-E, universities. When they took our money, well, I knew then. We owned the whole school. Now, early in the 70s, maybe Tarkanian's athletic director or his president didn't even know he did this deal. The coaches got their shoes and all that. But I know one thing. When it was an all-school day, you had an athletic director had to sign off. The president of the school had to sign off. This is like state universities. Nike won the world. And for all intents and purposes, the myth about amateurism was destroyed that day, because you were committing the whole of the university to all these things here. The whole of the university. So this company who had... You couldn't do anything on that ground. And that was my thought, without it being a Nike or an Adidas or a Reebok or Under Armour. And that's where we are now. The all-school day deal changed the world. And any person that wants to argue the silly argument, there's no basis for logic in that when you just be common sense and take all bias and prejudice out of the beer.
Right, yeah, it changes the nature, for sure, of how colleges and sports interact, for sure.
Can't miss it.
Okay, well, yeah, obviously, we've talked about all these different experiences you had at Nike. You don't work for Nike anymore, so I don't know if you're willing to talk about why you left Nike and explored other options.
Well, I got fired from Nike. Michael... And myself and Howard White, who still works for Nike, and my wife Pam, I was closer than anybody in the world to Michael Jordan. There's nobody, that's not even close. I did a TV special for him on NBC with Billy Crystal for the homeless people. The money went to Michael's charity and our charity, the homeless. I took Michael on a personal tour of Europe with a private plane at the time of the Gulf War. Because Michael didn't want, we were going to send a commercial. It was just me, Pam, Howard, and Michael in the plane. Michael had the first shovel full of dirt for the Barcelona Olympics, opening the new stadium. We went from Spain to Germany to Paris. We come home. Michael and Magic Johnson were going to sue. After we got home, Michael and Magic Johnson were going to sue the NBA because they didn't want to sell their T-shirts with their faces and their names on it. They thought they deserved it, and they sued and won that case. They better went back and gave in to the Players Association. But I did everything with Michael. I started a camp for him, which evolved into his, the fantasy camps and all that. Michael and I put up the money to start it. I stayed at his home. So I had to say this to your audience. I come home. It's August 15th, I believe. I go to Nike. They tell me come up an emergency thing. I just thought I was going up here to talk about Michael suing. And Phil fired me. And, I don't know. I think I know. I think it's logical to expect why. I was doing a lot of things. I started charity games. I was doing things, with Michael that were personal, like the camp. And, you know, in Saturday Night Live, I was the only person in the green room with him. Jesse Jackson was outside. Pam and I were inside because he did the Saturday Night Live because the people at Comic Relief helped him, and Billy and Whoopi and all the Billy Crystal, Robin Williams, and Whoopi Goldberg were the three people who started that whole charity. So I was close, and he just got, you know, he fired me. Whatever. So that, I don't know how else to make it. I always hurt, and you know, but I guess they had reasons. And I guess I understood. I've never accepted anything about the downsides of my life as any setback at all. I just went on to continue. Would I have always thought I was going to die with Nike shoes on my feet? Yeah. In the 80s and 90s, I certainly did. I mean, I'm not bitter, and I never was bitter at Nike. I was always hurt. Because without Nike and Phil Knight and Rob Strasser, I'm not talking to you on the phone today. All the things that came after that, it was because of Michael Jordan, just so we understand that. I am the first.
Right.
All the things I did, and I did things prior to Michael to get me to Michael, it was all Michael Jordan. There's no question about that. And I still have great, great respect, and I'm proud of what he's doing. Every time he sells another shoe, I feel more proud.
Okay, well, yeah, no, that's a good perspective, and again, trying to look at this at the lessons of your life and how they could apply to other people. You know, obviously, when there's that ton of money involved, you know, in any business, there's going to be egos and things like that as well, and so those are all things to take into account. And you were fired, like you said. That wasn't the end of your career either. I mean, you went on to have successful experiences with Adidas and Reebok and doing lots of different things. So, I mean, it's not the end of the world, and I think that's a valuable lesson for people to take as well.
You know, Peter, and I thank you for saying that, but I think, again, to the people listening, you know, like I said, I would have loved to have stayed there, but once I was let go, you can't, I mean, this happens to people every day of their life. It's going to happen to people listening. It's going to happen to students at the university. This is what life is. And when you bitch and moan about it, and, you know, then you kill yourself. And, you know, what good is that? I mean, and in fact, I think, I honestly believe, now, I'm going to quantify this, okay, by saying to you, again, Michael gave me the entree to the world. There's no question about that. There's no soul man. There's no nothing. You know, because Michael, but rightfully so, I was that person. In all the companies I worked for, I was that person. I did the job I had to do. But I like the second part of my life is my life. I think what I, you know, we talked about the thing with the athletes and all that sort of stuff. I love it, but I never let, you know, we were successful with Adidas too. In the short time I stayed at Reebok, we are successful. We had the company going, and you know, ironically, Reebok sold for like billions of dollars. They sold their company to Adidas, who I just quit because of what they did with LeBron and all those sort of things. But my life has been, you know, I think that the athletes today, I've had a good life. We've made a couple of dollars. Pam and I've touched a lot of people in the sense that there's a lot of people that, you know, stay in touch with me, or I know, or they responded to that show. That show was the number one show, the ESPN show that night. I mean, it was, you know, so obviously people are aware of the things I've done, agreeing with me and disagreeing with me. But I think that's fine.
Yeah, no, and I think that's fine too. So yeah, rather than discussing the rest of your career with Adidas and Reebok, which is interesting stuff, and people can learn about that if they watch the documentary and there's books and things like that. So rather than continuing to talk about that, why don't we move into talking about your experience now for the past couple of years in your life dealing with NCAA issues. Is that all right with you?
Absolutely love to.
So this is the end of part one of the podcast with Sonny Vaccaro. Stay tuned for part two, in which we discuss his advocacy on behalf of college athletes. This has been an episode of the Sports Law Biz podcast. This podcast is available through the Sports Law Biz website or through iTunes, Stitcher, SoundCloud, and YouTube. Before wrapping things up, I'd like to thank some people. First of all, I'd like to thank my friend, Lieb Montoya, for designing the Sports Law Biz podcast logo, as well as the Sports Law Biz blog logo. His artistic ability certainly surpasses mine. If interested, you can check out more of Lieb's work on Instagram and Twitter His handle is at Lieb Montoya in both places. That's at L-I-B Montoya. Additionally, I'd like to thank the musical artist for providing this theme music that you're listening to right now. The artist is a band called The Losers. The album is entitled Young, Tough, Terrible. The track is Sports with an exclamation point. The label is Needle Drop Co. This music is available through a Creative Commons license of Attribution Non-Commercial 3.0 Unported. This podcast was produced and recorded by myself, Peter Ott, and you can reach me at my personal Twitter handle, at PeterJOTT, through the Sports Law Biz Twitter handle, at SportsLawBiz, or through email at SportsLawBizBlog@gmail.com. Any feedback is greatly appreciated. If you are interested in contributing to either the Sports Law Biz blog or podcast, definitely reach out to me. I love to talk to people about these issues, and I know I can use all the help I can get. Finally, I'd like to thank you for listening to this podcast. Hopefully it was enjoyable. If so, please spread the word and let your friends and colleagues know about it. Leave a review on iTunes. Any way you can spread the news about this podcast would be greatly appreciated. That's our episode today. Tune in next time to learn more about the law and business of sports. I'm looking forward to discussing it with you on the Sports Law Biz podcast.